was an unknown wilderness. It wasn't long before they went into the wide valleys of Kentucky through the Cumberland Gap.
Welcome to this edition of Old Kentucky Tales, the only podcast that solemnly swears that none of its participants have ever showed up uninvited to a Klan rally. Today's title is Crashing the Klan, a live podcast recording coming to you from the Pogue Library reading room on the campus of Murray State University. I am your host, Brent Taylor, assistant professor of history at West Kentucky Community and Technical College. And with me is the man who vehemently disagrees with the old Benjamin Franklin adage that well done is better than well said. He is an associate professor of communication at WKCTC, Jason Donner.
I don't like things well done. I like them medium rare.
I'm a well done man myself. Yeah.
Never been invited or never shown up or invited or not invited to a Klan rally, by the way.
That's probably an important
asterisk. Yeah, we should point that out.
We need to asterisk that. Yeah, I think so. We are with a very special guest, a man who believes wholeheartedly that the current president is the greatest since the Obama administration, MSU professor Dr. Brian Clardy.
And that would be fake news, Brent, but thank you for having me on anyway.
All right, then. In this episode of Old Kentucky Tales, the main event will include a tremendously underrated story about how the Reverend W.G. Harvey crashed a Klan rally in Paducah in the summer of 1975. We'll also hear some reactions to the show from our Old Kentucky voicemails. And along the way, don't forget to support the fake history sponsors who support Old Kentucky Tales. The products are real, only the sponsorship is fake.
The President of the United States.
The late General Harrison's carriage for sale. The undersigned is agents for Mrs. General Harrison. Offers for sale the splendid carriage presented to General H by the citizens of Baltimore. It is as good as new, never having been used more than 10 or a dozen times. Its original cost was $2,500 and can be purchased for one-third of that sum. It can be seen at the coach manufacturer of Mr. J&B Bruce in Cincinnati. The subscriber will meet anyone in Cincinnati at any time if notified by letter at Cleves Post Office, Hamilton County, Ohio. William H.H. Taylor, agent for Mrs. Anna Harrison.
So this is somebody who is... He's died, and she's basically just getting rid of his vehicle.
That's true, except it's not just somebody. It's a really important person. This is a VIP vehicle. Uh-huh. This is the former president's vehicle, William Henry Harrison.
Oh, okay.
And the woman who's selling it is the former first lady.
Okay. Wonder what happened to that thing.
I guess they sold it, right? I
mean, that's not made clear.
This is the ad in the paper. Now, Dr. Clardy, isn't this cool? Wouldn't you buy, for example, Richard Nixon's limousine?
Well, it would depend. If there's a taping system, probably not. But as a showpiece, I probably would. I have a love-hate relationship with Richard Nixon. I think he was a very brilliant president. He had a very strong mind and a very strong will, but he really did some kind of stupid and ill-advised things. But he had great taste in cars.
And Brent, let me ask you one thing about this, too.
Yeah.
They're called, you know, he's called General Harrison. Was that common then, too, even after being president, they would refer to him, you know, politely as General Harrison?
I think that's probably true. I think that General Jackson, for example, was always General Jackson, no matter what.
And he preferred that, right?
Yeah, I think I just keep seeing that.
But, you know, after Dwight Eisenhower left the presidency in 1961, President Kennedy restored him to the status of a full general. So he was referred to as General Eisenhower up until his death in 1969. Okay, so I can see that kind of working.
Right, yeah.
Okay, even in the 20th century, same kind of deal. Yeah, it's just, I guess it's how they knew him.
Right.
It was part of it.
Right.
For sure. That's true. Now, though, we've had a little bit of listener feedback.
Oh, okay. Another phone call?
Yeah, we got another one of those phone calls, and we just need to see what was said.
Thanks for calling Old Kentucky Tales. For English, press 1.
Para español, marque 2 ahora.
For old-timely Kentucky talk, dial 3 on your rotary phone right now, y'all.
Your call is important to us. All of our historians, speech critiquers, and producers are currently unavailable. If you know your party's four-digit extension number, you may dial now. For all other inquiries and comments, stay on the line and leave a message after the tone.
Like, I wanted to call and tell you guys that I heard the episode about World War I food. When you said that ice cream is like a food and not a luxury, I was like, yeah, you totally read my mind, man. Like, I really enjoyed it, but it gave me, like, the biggest case of the munchies I ever had. Zoinks! I almost ate a box of dog food, man.
So that was Shaggy.
Of a certain general. The zoinks kind of gave it away.
It was really.
I guess that's probably right, isn't it?
It's almost like he's struggling to talk.
Yeah, he's so excited because it was the World War I food episode.
Yeah,
so what do you think? Is ice cream a food or a luxury?
Luxury, big time luxury. I don't see where it's filling at all. And I believe me, I have tried.
Yeah, it is not filling, but it doesn't keep me from trying.
I didn't see Shaggy eating that a lot, though. They're just piling up sandwiches all the time on show.
The triple-decker kind.
It was all about really tall sandwiches and hot dogs and things.
And boxes of dog food.
That's true, yeah. The Scooby Snacks.
Yeah, that's it. But it's good to know that we had some positive feedback, because last time it was negative feedback. And I like the positive kind.
Right. Even if it's make-believe, it's a cartoon character.
No, that's real.
Oh, that's real.
That's totally real. And you can't convince me otherwise. Mm. But now, the moment we've all been waiting for.
The main event.
Round one.
And this is a really, really underrated story.
Absolutely.
About a guy who's, I think, more important than the due that he gets out there in the history sphere.
Sure.
It's the Reverend W.G. Harvey. He was a Paducah civil rights leader. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Clardy, tell us a little bit about him.
Well, he was the pastor for many years of Harrison Street Baptist Church. When my mother was in WKCTC at the time, it was called West Kentucky Technical, she went there to become a secretary before she went into teaching later on, but that was her first post high school program. Well, anyway, she was a parishioner of Reverend Harvey's, and she spoke very, very highly of him, and that's all I heard about growing up. He was pastor still at Harrison Street Baptist Church and still involved in civil rights activity, even in the 1970s. Of course, he knew Dr. King, and he knew all the great leaders and so forth. As it turned out, a young Klansman named David Duke was going to be coming to Paducah to lead a rally at the Civic Center, and Reverend Harvey decided to crash it. And he did, and made it out alive.
That's a pretty good feat. So when it comes to that moment, that takes a pretty good intestinal fortitude, doesn't it?
You could say that. It's something that I would have been terrified to do, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's true.
So what happened? I mean, what did he report that occurred while he was there?
When he first got there, of course, interestingly, a couple of people were let out on stretchers being taken to the hospital. Some African-American men, there had been some scuffles there, which, you know, that would have been my first indication. Don't go in.
Right.
But as Reverend Harvey surmised, the Civic Center was a public space. And the law said, well, you know, you can actually go in. And, of course, when he went in and sat down, he heard more than his share of the N-word, as you can well imagine. And David Duke kind of made some allusions to that in his remarks. But Reverend Harvey sat through that discussion, and like I said, that takes guts of steel, but he sat through that, and he made it out alive and alive to tell the tale. And it was a story that he regaled years later when I met him in the 1990s.
Was this something that was covered in the newspaper locally too a lot? Or that, you know, this was a real story going on?
I had heard about it. I was 8 years old when it happened, so I don't know if WPSD ran a story on it. Maybe
right.
The Paducah Sun did, it's possible. That would be a headliner for sure, but
right.
I don't think much was made of it nationally or on the statewide level.
Right.
Yeah, and that's interesting because he really was an important local civil rights leader.
Yes.
So he was known for getting businesses on board with desegregation.
He did.
And civil rights, isn't that right?
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
And working and getting everybody voluntarily to do it.
Yes.
Which I think is really important as well.
And using nonviolent tactics and hardcore negotiations, he was able to pull that off. He was not just a transformational figure, but he was clearly a transactional figure in that regard.
Yeah, and so, I mean, he ran for city council.
Yes.
From time to time.
Yes.
And I've seen some of that campaign paraphernalia, and it just seems moderate, common sense. Do you think that was the secret to success?
I believe so. Reverend Harvey was not a starry-eyed individual. He was a pragmatist in many respects. He was determined, and he got most of what he wanted, but he was very practical and very smart and very strategic in the way that he did things.
Dr. Clutter, let me ask you another question about that moment. What do you think he was really thinking? I mean, what do you think really motivated him? He thought that was so important to show up.
Well, I can't get into his mind or his spirit now or even ask him now since he's passed away, but this is what I would surmise from that, that he was bold, he was determined to make a point, that he was determined to make a point that the Ku Klux Klan was not going to come into Paducah and him not make some hay about
right.
it.
Right, yeah.
But he did so in a way that was very public, because had something happened to him physically, I guarantee you Paducah would have been up in arms over it. So he certainly took that into his calculus. Plus, he didn't go in there with a weapon. He didn't go in there belligerently. He just simply went to listen.
Right.
And that was a very, very pregnant symbol of his courage.
Right. And it gave him an opportunity to not let them have their way about it either.
Right.
You know, it disrupted, I suppose, what they'd hoped for. You know, that's not what they wanted, and
absolutely.
That was important to do.
Certainly, certainly. That type of courage is certainly lacking these days, because, as I said, personally, that's not something I would have done. I would not have walked into the middle of a Klan rally
listened. That is tough, sure.
That is very dangerous, yes.
Now, did this become kind of legendary within the church?
It became legendary throughout Western Kentucky.
Yeah.
And when he gave his, he spoke to the African American Heritage Ball back in 2008, the person who introduced him, the head of the Multicultural Center here at Murray State, S.G. Carthel, mentioned that. That was one of the first things that he mentioned when he introduced Reverend Harvey that night to speak to our banquet.
So that kind of became a defining moment for him personally.
Absolutely.
As you would expect it to.
He had met people. He had met King. He had met all the great civil rights leaders, even in the mid-1950s, before King became a household name. And I suppose that would give a leader some gravitas. But the way that he stood up in the 1970s certainly made him a local legend for sure.
Yeah, and that makes sense, because it's not just that he knew somebody important, but that he was somebody important.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what about, let me ask you another question about David Duke. At that time, he was a young man. Was he a national figure then, or was he just
not yet
kind of coming up the ranks, so to speak?
He was coming up the ranks. I would say that I started becoming familiar with Duke in the 1980s.
Okay.
When he headed up an organization called the National Association for the Advancement of White People and made a run for the Democratic nomination for president in 1988. Not that he was going to win, but he made that run. And I think by the time we get to the 1980s, he is certainly a very strong figure within the Klan and the nationalist movement,
right.
Generally.
Okay.
Yeah, that makes sense, because this is sort of where he is trying to make the name for himself,
right.
and all that stuff. That's exactly right. Is there anything else that you kind of remember personally about Reverend Harvey, or some of the things that your family said that you'd want to add to this?
My mother said that he was a very dynamic preacher, and I actually heard him in the early 1980s myself. The night before Bill Clinton was elected to the presidency, there was a huge rally at Barclay Field, and I happened to go to that. And Reverend Harvey gave the invocation, and he had to have been asked by the campaign to do that. No pastor is just going to walk up and say, hey, can I pray? No, that doesn't happen. You have to be asked to. So apparently his credibility as a leader was potent enough to have been asked by the Clinton-Gore campaign to do that. And I had some meetings with Reverend Harvey of some things I was trying to do in the 1990s, pushing for some progressive reforms, and I found him to be a very very good listener, for one. He heard everything you said, and he was very practical in the way that he dealt with public policy and trying to affect social change.
So practicality and pragmatism.
Yes.
Might be a pretty good summary.
And his prophetic nature, of course, he was strongly rooted in the Hebrew prophets, in the Gospels, in the New Testament writers, and he knew his way around Bible doctrine as well.
Right, right. And so regarding that, were there any times that he connected the two?
He connected the two constantly. He considered himself, and I think it's very, very important to recognize, he considered himself a prophetic voice, that after 1968, the civil rights movement had not ended, that there was still some work to do. And so I think that was the vantage point that Reverend Harvey worked from.
Wow.
How do your students react in class when you tell these kinds of stories, kind of true local stories for these students, a lot of them from this area?
That's interesting you had mentioned that, because I'm always telling stories to emphasize things in my American history courses and in my World Civ courses, and when I teach diplomatic history in the fall. One of the reactions I get from students sometimes is interest. They want to know more, and they may ask me something in the break, or they may send me an email. But I think students are really drawn to hearing those type of hands-on stories. Yes, they're going to read the book, they're going to do the homework, but when you tell them stories like that, stories that are not in print necessarily,
right,
I think that they are very attracted to those stories.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not one that I had ever heard before until we were able to do this.
Yes.
And I think it's really important to include that kind of thing in your classroom.
Sure.
And that generation gets to hear these kinds of stories from even the 1970s.
That is true.
I agree with that, Jason. We do have to pay some bills, though, and our sponsor for this part of the program is Liberty National Bank and Trust Company. Savings won't grow in a sugar bowl. Put your money to work at 3.5% interest in a Liberty Savings Account. Member FDIC. So, Dr. Clardy, this is from the mid-20th century.
Okay.
1964, and I think it's calling out to the Great Depression generation.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Because they lost faith in banks.
They sure did.
And so then they started sticking money in really weird places.
Mattresses. Sugar bowls.
Glass jars in the backyard that are buried.
Crawl spaces.
Did you have any relatives like this who they gave up on the bank and they stuck it somewhere weird?
I noticed my grandfather, when he died in 1978, he had some odd coins and dollar bills in mason jars under his bed. There weren't a whole lot of them, but I did notice that he...
Just enough.
And it's something
in case
like
there was an emergency.
When you're a little kid that you'll see, you know, maybe at your grandparents' house and you see those collection of old coins, $2 bills, that kind of thing.
And then you wonder why that's the case, but then when you study how that generation felt about banking and bank failures and all that in the 1930s, then it gives it some context. You understand a lot more.
Yeah, that's true. What about you, Jason? You have any relatives put some money in some weird places?
Oh, I remember what I had. My mother had lots of just a collection of coins I loved to look at as a little boy, and it was kind of in this large Tootsie Roll container. It was actually a bank, which probably had candy in it, but it was a good memory of always just like, I want to see those coins. And there would be Canadian coins, and she actually had some money that her brother had brought back from Vietnam.
Oh.
So that was kind of neat to see things like that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they just didn't trust the banks anymore. That's true. So, Jason, you are to the moment that you always hate the most, and that is the takeaway.
What's that?
I thought you
meant the ending.
No, you love the ending. You hate the takeaway.
Yeah, the takeaway. Well, I mean, this is an easy one because, as I said, you know, it's just, this was a really neat story. I don't think it's something that a lot of people, I don't know. I guess there are people who commonly or live around here that know this story, but I've never heard it. I suspect there are a lot of younger people that have never heard it. And I think it's just terribly interesting. And the fact that David Duke was part of that, who went on to be such a national
villain.
In his younger days, ended up in Paducah. And the Reverend, you know, stood up and made his point when he had that chance.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
And to be honestly, and I say this as a historian, now the onus is going to fall on me to do some follow-up and see what we can do insofar as putting this story in print.
That's a great idea. Yeah. Yeah, yes, that's
true.
A good idea.
I just published a piece on Congressman Ed Jones and his Watergate correspondence. And it was well received. It was published in the papers of the West Tennessee Historical Society papers. And for that, I won the 2016 Marshall Wingfield Award for that. And so now I think I have something to do for summer.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry about that. We gave you a little bit of work.
Yeah, homework. Project.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. We have now turned to the final page of this chapter, but never fear.
Well, thank you for coming. Yeah.
Thank you for having me here. This was great.
It's always fun to have a guest.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's why we do what we do. You can download even more episodes on iTunes.
That's right.
NPR One app. If you like what you hear, please leave a review or rate us. If you did not like what you heard, you didn't make it all the way to the end of the podcast. Yeah. Too bad.
Just forget you heard that part.
Special thanks to our producer, Todd Birdsong, the Paducah School of Art and Design, the Pogue Library, Dr. Brian Clardy, WKMS, and the rest is history.